with Greta and brothers and sisters. I think for the first time, climate change has, at least in Europe, left the expert circles.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. We sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics.
My name is David Wortmann. Claude Turmes is the energy minister of Luxembourg. As a long-term member of the European Parliament, he is probably the most experienced politician for the energy transition at the European Union level. And he is the guest of our first English edition of Let's Talk Change. He will walk us through 20 years of ups and downs of EU policymaking to increase the share of renewable energy. He tells us about how he has been driving change and what are the three key ingredients to become a real changemaker. Enjoy listening and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Hello, welcome Claude Turmes. I think you're a very interesting guest to our podcast.
I hope so.
So why don't you just introduce yourself?
So I'm Claude Turmes, I'm Luxembourg, so in Luxembourg in Europe, so this is a small country between Germany, France and Belgium native. Basically I have been Friends of the Earth, so green activists from end of the 80s to end of the 90s, and then in 99 I had the huge opportunity to be elected to the European Parliament, where I was the spokesperson for the Green Party and involved in a lot of EU legislation on markets, renewables, efficiency, and now I'm a minister for energy, so I have now this kind of obligation to transpose all this legislation which basically I have negotiated, so which is a funny thing.
I think already shown how much experience you have had of driving change. This is the main topic I would like to talk about in this podcast here, how change can be driven, how change can happen. And maybe before we start that, do you have your own definition of change? How would you define change? And maybe more specifically as well, how would you define change in the ecologic and energy transition? Because this is the main topic you have been working on.
Change is, I think, leaving an old world, in this case the fossil nuclear complex, or with all its lobbyists, economic distortion, and so on and so on, and then going into a new world, which is a diverse set of renewables. And then, of course, it's more complex than just solar and wind. It's also about grids, about electromobility, and so on, so on. So I think change is about daring to leave something which you know well and being optimistic that there is something even more thrilling ahead. So that would be my personal definition.
So you just said in the 90s you were with Friends of the Earth, so it's an environmental organization. And then in 1999 you became member of the European Parliament. It was your first time being a politician, elected politician as well. How did you back then define your own, let's say, success, and how did you define your objectives against your expectations, which you probably have built up ahead of the election?
Yeah, I think the European Parliament is, at least for Europe, a very specific, atypical parliament, because it's at the difference of national parliaments, which are in a black and white system. So you have elections, your party wins, your fellow members go into a government. You, as a member of parliament, basically what you do is you raise your hands to support them. And then after 4 or 5 years, you basically, there's a new election. And if you are a member of parliament and you are not with the majority, with the government, then basically you are in opposition. And opposition means you shout during 4 and 5 years in the hopes that you, with shouting and being very vigorous, you are able to persuade the electorate that next time you should be in the government. So that's the normal parliamentary system in Europe. And there's one parliament which is different, that is the European Parliament, because in the European Parliament you have not as clear majorities. So you, of course, you have a commission president which is elected on a ticket, let's say, conservatives, liberals and social democrats, but for each and every legislation you have changing majorities. And when I got into the European Parliament in 99, and from then until today, basically I always was the majority when it came to energy. Why is that? Because I was able, or we were able, to build a coalition of the progressive, which is then on energy policy, it was the Greens, the Liberals, very astonishingly. So there is liberal parties and liberal parties. So the German Liberals are almost an anti-green, anti-renewable party, whereas the British Lib Dem or the Danish or some of the Dutch Liberals are in a certain sense green liberal parties. So you had to win them over, and then you have Social Democrats, which often are also, when it comes to energy, not always but often with the progressive camp, plus those who are even more left. And then you needed another 4 or 5 votes, and for that you divided the conservatives, so the Portuguese conservatives are pro-renewables, the Spanish conservatives are pro-renewables, the Scandinavians, the German conservatives, the French were against renewables. But at the end of the day, I was always able to build a majority. And this progressive majority in the parliament, plus EU Commission, who often wanted really this change from the fossil system to the renewable system, plus some progressive member states, that is what made Europe probably now the most sophisticated and most progressive green electricity or green energy place in the world.
Driving changes, or to drive changes, building coalitions are very crucial, as you just said. And of course, as an outsider, of somebody not being a politician, it's very complicated to see who is really part of your agenda, who's not part of your agenda. Would you say that at the European level, within the European Parliament, with the Commission as well, it is much easier to form this sort of coalition, let's say easier than in a national member state, for example, because you are less in the media, you are less, I don't know, maybe there is even less lobbying going on. Is this a fair thesis to say, or was it really a big, big task for you to build up this coalition?
So I think the one thing where it is easier in the European Parliament to build coalitions around topics and substance is because it's not a black and white parliament. So the most members of parliament specialize on, be it, agriculture or fishing or foreign policy. And then you have, 6, 8, 10, 12 who really try to understand the energy or climate agenda. And with these people, you can have really deep discussions also on substance, which is also a difference which maybe the national parliaments, where it's much more because of this black and white. You do not have even a culture of going deep because you do not want to have an agreement in a certain sense. And the other thing I would say at the European level is there's not less lobbying. I think there is substantial lobbying, which is not surprising, because if EU does a law, it's a law for an economy of 500 million citizens. So if there is a law on the efficiency of cars, the carbon footprint of the cars, you should not be surprised that Mercedes and Fiat and Renault, all car companies, are investing very heavily into lobbying and lobbyists. But on the other hand, you have also a lot of environmental organizations like Greenpeace, WWF, Friends of the Earth, who have really understood that most of the legislation in the field of energy, climate, transport, or a lot of these legislations are decided at EU level and then transposed nationally. So there is, in a certain sense, a relatively good equilibrium of forces, if I speak in Chomsky terms, and that enables then to really move forward.
Another element of driving change is that there's a certain sense of urgency as well, because otherwise people won't change and politicians may not change and things or systems are not going to change. Do you see that the sense of urgency for the energy transition, for climate change, has changed over the last 20 years? 2019 was the year of Greta Thunberg, of Fridays for Future, which really created some, let's say, sense of urgency. Is this a different quality today than back then in 1999 when you started, or even in 2009 when you were rapporteur of the Renewable Energy Directive?
Yes, there is a huge difference. So with Greta and brothers and sisters, or sisters and brothers, I think for the first time, climate change has, at least in Europe, left the expert circles. And it's now a real societal debate. I think when young people come home and question their parents, why do we buy another gas guzzler? So why do we still eat meat because of climate change? I think this is really, it brings a complete, it shakes up adults. And I think Greta and Sisters and Brothers is great because it has brought the climate debate out of experts. I entered that game in late 80s when the German Bundestag issued a report on climate change. German Bundestag Enquete Commission, one policymaker, one scientist, and I had to study this for an exam. And when I had finished these 350 pages, for me it was clear, if this report is right, so if more CO2 creates a higher temperature and then higher temperature melting of glaciers and more dynamics in the atmosphere, in 88 the climate science was well enough established. And so I'm in a certain sense, after having read that, I'm in urgency since then. My problem was that because it was not recognized as a societal priority, there were windows of opportunity. So there were moments where we had the right political majorities to move.
This was, for example, in 2009.
So the Renewable Directive was also the whole energy package, which was the merit of people which you would not at first glance classify in the climate fighter brigade, which is Tony Blair, who launched it in 2006. And then you had Angela Merkel on her very first European Council meeting their prime ministers. She was, I think she probably surprised them all by bullying them into the 2020 targets, so 20% greenhouse gas reduction, 20% renewables, 20% raise of the energy efficiency on her very first council. So even today, with the mixed policies in Germany on car industry or coal, she still has a bit this nimbus of a climate chancellor, but this is back. So her real merit on climate change was somewhere in 2007 when she made the EU heads of states decide the 2020. And then you had a strange person like Nicolas Sarkozy, who despite Lehman Brothers, in the middle of Lehman Brothers, so we are October, November, December, the European financial system, the world financial system, there is nights where it's very close to crash, the beginning of a huge economic crisis, and still under the influence of Borloo, his minister for ecology, Sarkozy keeps the whole renewable energy efficiency climate package on the table, and we get to decisions in December 2008, and that is basically putting Europe a window of opportunity. But then again,
this was maybe not even a coincidence, right? Do you think that now, looking back a little bit in history as well, and looking at this very crucial moment of the global financial crisis as well, that this maybe even have helped the renewable energy and climate change agenda, because people thought there must be more out there than just saving the economic system? Or was it despite of that situation?
No, it was really despite, because we were lucky that after Lehman Brothers, which is September 2008, the political mainstream was so under shock that they were basically allowing nevertheless the climate package to go ahead. The reaction to that came in 2010-11-2012, when the power companies Electrabel Suez, EDF, RWE, E.ON, so the big European power companies, started to understand what we had done. We had done efficiency policy which was freezing the electricity consumption in Europe, so same volume of sales. And in that same volume of sales, we injected, instead of 8% of renewables, 20% of renewables, which means for electricity, 35% renewables. So de facto, the package which we were able to pass in December 2008 was exploding the business model of the electricity companies in Europe. And so they used the reaction, and it was 2011-2012, when Mestrallet, who was the CEO of this Gaz de France Electrabel consortium, when he was able to get all the CEOs of all the major power companies together in a lobby group which was called the Magritte Group, because they met in a museum which Gaz de France was sponsoring in Brussels. And they went then in 2012 and 13 to each and every prime minister and saying renewables are bad, they are costly, they will explode the grid, efficiency is bad for the overall economy. So then we had really what I say is the Black October in Europe, which was October 2014, when Europe decided this very weak 2030 targets of 27% efficiency, 37% renewables, only 40% greenhouse gas, which is completely not Paris compatible. That was really then under the influence of the economic crisis, that those who had lost the battle on renewables and efficiency, so the very big establishment from the big oligopolies, they used then the economic crisis to try to weaken down what we had decided. And then luckily with the last commission and again with the progressive parliament, with support of governments like Spain, a bit of France, a bit of Germany, Netherlands, Luxembourg, the Scandinavians, we were able again to pull it up to what where we are today, which is 32% renewable, 32% 5 efficiency. And now the breakthrough with the new Commission President von der Leyen, where Europe finally also at the Prime Minister's level has to go to where the science tells us, which is net zero in 2050 and the 50 to 55% reduction greenhouse in 2030. So it's
this
happening.
Is the so-called new Green Deal, right?
Of let's be honest, von der Leyen is a German conservative. The German conservative Merkel was against going from 40% to 55%. Why did von der Leyen pledge 50 or 55? Because the day before she had to win a majority in the European Parliament to be allowed to be a Commission President, she had no majority. So she had to offer something to certain liberals who wanted to have climate change being taken serious, and she won over some Greens in the last moment because she was finally accepting that Europe has to do its part of the game and move to 50-55. So this was done under the political bargaining of having a majority in the European Parliament. And then, of course, she was clever enough to say, okay, if I have to move, I want to move in a way that it is making sense. And the Green New Deal is a step change because for the first time we are bringing energy and climate and transport policy out of these silos and moving it into the broader economic policy, or basically the offer of Europe, what is Europe offering for their citizens, and a global dimension, which was also completely missing in the decades before. So the Green New Deal, I think, is now a huge opportunity. And of course, that is the result of that majorities after the European elections, where the Greens did great. So the Greens are now almost in a swing position. So they have leverage in the European Parliament. And of course, Greta and sisters and brothers. So national governments are also now much more under pressure to deliver on climate and energy transitions than before.
So there were a number of external factors, politically, public perception, etc., which really helped to create these windows of opportunities we just talked about. But looking back those 20 years now, what were the main barriers you have experienced, and how did you, let's say, tackle those barriers? And do you see like a systematic approach to get rid of these barriers?
I think the key barrier was the energy oligopolies, so the nuclear lobby, the coal lobby, the gas lobby, the car lobby. They don't care about the planet, they care for profits. So they had to build up a system which was very profitable for them. So we had to defeat them in their influence with the political majorities in the European Commission, in the European Parliament, and then with the governments. I think that is the single biggest barrier. And then, of course, what helped is that basically is technological innovation. The first wind turbines were more expensive than those we build today. The first wind turbines were smaller. This offshore wind is a fantastic European success story. So we started almost from nothing, and today we know that we can build out 450 gigawatts. So basically one of the ways of Europe to win is large-scale big offshore wind, which is producing electricity cheaper than coal and gas. What has helped a lot since 2011, 12, 15, 16 is that the prices or the cost for renewables have come down.
And the prices really came down because you really created the market through policy frameworks, right? And this is different than, let's say, the 10, 20, even 30 years before the 1990s, where most of the governments have given some R&D programs, some R&D money, but the market wasn't really created. But with the Renewable Energy Directive 2009, with the Energy Efficiency Directive in 2012, you really created and enabled a market which helped down to bring down the cost through scaling up manufacturing, etc. And do you think, because there were some more business opportunities now being created, that the barrier which you just described around this oligopoles or the nuclear fossil energy has now gone away, and that because they see this business opportunity, they now jump into this game, and so maybe the change is now instituted?
I think you made a very important point. The Renewable Energy Directive created a mass market for solar energy in Europe, for wind onshore energy, for wind offshore energy, and even for also for biomass. And so it is these huge volume markets which were the prerequisite to drive down the costs of technologies who have existed since long. So I have found recently papers from end of the 80s, where the solar power existed end of the 80s. And what we are doing today is a bit better in efficiency, but it's not that what made the difference. The difference was that governments were ready to pay for substantial support and the mass volume. So the German Trittin and others feed-in law was, of course, the first pull, and then others have to replicate. Yesterday evening, I discussed with a British politician, it's so evident, the European Renewable Directive with binding national target against the opposition of almost the whole British energy establishment was the prerequisite to force Britain to go massively offshore wind. So without the European Directive on renewables, we would not have created a mass market for offshore wind. And of course, once we have now driven down the costs, what's the choice of RWE or ENGIE or E.ON? So if you miss E.ON and RWE controlled 80% of the German power market when it was coal and nuclear, and on the renewable side they didn't even have 5%. And that was nice as long as it was a niche. Today Germany has a 45% renewable share, which means that these big oligopolies were completely out of the market. And it's interesting to see that E.ON and RWE, who were politically dominating everything in Germany, everything, that now they had to merge in order to have some influence in the recent coal exit strategy. And the only reason for their merge was to have enough leverage to get more money on the table for the coal phase out, because if E.ON would have had an interest to go against RWE, the German government would not have been pushed so much, so heavily into paying all this, I think, not unnecessary money for the buyout of the coal power plant. So it's interesting to see when companies miss the moment that then they can even disappear.
So, I mean, we talk about change, right? And a lot has happened the last 20 years. We talked about one-off opportunities. We talked about barriers. A lot has been achieved looking back. I mean, I think in 1999, nobody would have dreamed something like the Green Deal of the European Commission now. And I don't know how much the percentage of renewable energy is right now in Europe in general, but in some member states very high already. Do you think that the change has now been instituted, so there is no way back again, and change is just now going to happen towards maybe a 100% renewable energy agenda? Or is this change still something which needs to be embraced and enforced and worked on? What is your take on that? Are we more or less moving in a very good direction?
I think that we are moving in the right direction. The fact that we have the Paris Agreement, the fact that member states are through the international Paris pressure plus the European climate policy pressure now obliged to these very detailed energy and climate plans 2030. So this creates a framework which is more difficult to derail than the frameworks we had before. But the costs for renewables have come down, the cost for batteries are coming down, so electromobility will also come much faster than we had hoped for, which is good. But I think there's one crucial moment now, which is this Greta moment. Are we able to keep it, to sustain it? Because it's clear when a net zero society is something which you will see on the streets. So it's something which is such a deep change that this is no more the easy stuff. So it's easy to build out a big offshore wind park outside, but it's much more complex, for example, to renovate the whole existing building stock in Europe or to close down city centers for what it should be, a nice place to walk around and to buy again, to have some skateboards or electric engines of all kinds of one and two wheelers to move around. I think it's important that we care now for keeping this social acceptance. And that social acceptance is, of course, most threatened in old industry areas like coal regions. And therefore, I'm quite proud also to have been one of the advocates and investigators, the one who pushed it for this just transition fund, so that we have money on the table for these two Greek regions who are today in coal. And we need to be tough on coal, but we need to be extremely emphatic with the families who have worked in the coal mines and the whole population from these coal regions. We have to build up a new economy, especially in those areas who were stuck in a certain sense in the old world. So I think there's a huge challenge now to keep the broader societal acceptance. And for that, we need a good narrative, a good storytelling. We need really to care for the daily. What is the energy transition? So what does solar energy mean in the daily life for European? And then, of course, even more a daily life of an African farm. This kind of link needs to be done now.
So now you're a minister in Luxembourg, the responsible minister for energy since 1 year. And I believe, I think you still have 4 years to go. What are your objectives now? Not only just to change, let's say, the energy transition in Luxembourg, but how can you leverage your minister post as well for the European development?
I think the first thing is, if you want to be credible, you have to do your homework. So we are now in the final phase of our energy and climate plan. We have moved our national target from 40% greenhouse gas reduction to 55%. So that's Paris compatible. We have moved our renewable target from hardly 11% to 25%. So which is, we will do 10 times more solar than we had installed now. And we have the sharpest energy efficiency target of all, which is a 40 to 44%, because Luxembourg is a very dynamic economy. We are growing in population faster than Mexico in relative terms. So I have every day more buildings, every day more mobility. So if I want to bridge between a very dynamic economy and net zero, I have to be hyper or ultra or whatever you may call it efficient. And that means strict standards for buildings, electromobility to be one of the front runner, to do everything we can on energy efficiency in the industrial processing. So now is the phase to put all these kind of laws in place so that I really have an environment that in Luxembourg energy efficiency is an absolute priority in all sectors of the economy. So that's, of course, then you can say tiny Luxembourg with little volume, but still it can be a showcase. Then Luxembourg is a part of the pentalateral power market. So there is no such thing like the Luxembourgish power market. We are in the Western European, German, France, Benelux power market. I spend a lot of time to get now, for example, electromobility over the borders, so fast charging stations in that Western Europe as the pioneering region in Europe. I work a lot with the North Sea countries on offshore wind because that is where my bulk electricity will come from. I'm not so far away from the North Sea. And then, of course, the biggest impact which Luxembourg can have is our financial center. So we are one of the world's biggest collector of money. There is 5,000 billion euro or dollar transiting through Luxembourg. We are in the top three places for investment funds. The European Investment Bank, which is the world's biggest public investment bank, is based in Luxembourg. And so what we are doing now as a government is trying to be one of the front runners on green finance with strict labels where, for example, nuclear is not qualifying, CCS is not qualifying, first generation biofuels is not qualifying, but only the, let's say, the sustainable renewables like solar, wind. So to create a good environment for investment funds specialized on wind and solar to be located in Luxembourg, and then looking for de-risking funds. Can I help with some financial instruments to get the financing cost for solar energy in Western Africa down? If I would succeed in that, that would be, can trigger much more megawatt of solar in Western Africa through a dedicated vehicle who blends public money with private money. So that's more megawatt solar than I can ever do in Luxembourg. Plus our development aid, we have 7 target countries. And for example, with Cabo Verde, it's 400,000 inhabitants. We are 600,000. We are helping them now to be the first 100% renewable island states. That's what where we can go beyond. And of course, I'm sitting at the table when we do European legislation. So I will be at the forefront to fight for the phase out of fossil cars, to get even higher targets for renewables, to have finally a 100% renewable scenario for Europe, and not the scenario where we still have 40, 50, 60, I don't know, 80 new nuclear reactors, which is a bit the scenarios which Commission has today. So there's a lot to do, and even a small country minister has some leverage.
Last question. I mean, you have been proven the last 20 years and even longer that change is possible and positive change is possible as well. What is your advice? What are your main lessons to the new generation of Greta Thunberg, of Fridays for Future, if they become politicians, if they become maybe leaders in business? What is your main lesson of being successful driving change?
I think it's about passion. You have to be passionate. You really need, when you get up in the morning, you need to know why I'm going to my job. And then the second, you have to be professional. I think it's very important to know your stuff. You have to read, you have to consult with experts. And then policy is about being strategic. When you want to win these 3 points, phasing new coal power stations in Europe, the 550 gram limit, which I won in the latest market design legislation. So we had a clear strategy, which countries to buy in, how to move Commission, who was not with us in the beginning. It's passion, professionalism, and being strategic.
Thank you very much, Claude. I think we will still hear a lot from you, and maybe we can do another interview at some point just to track back how much you have changed and driven change since today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international clean tech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.